We certainly count ourselves as blessed to be here today. We are thankful for God's provisions in allowing us to be here together and to be encouraged by one another's company, to spend time in worship together. Truly a great blessing it is to be able to do so, but we recognize that there are many, even among this number of God's people, who are not able to enjoy that blessing right now. And to them, we certainly hope that that time can be here soon to where they can join us once again in person. But we are thankful that even as we endure such a situation as this, that we live in a time of technology, that they could even join us virtually. So to those of you who are here, good morning. Thank you for being here. And to those who might be joining us virtually, good morning to you. And thank you for joining us in our study. I invite all of us to open up our Bibles and to begin in Mark chapter 8 this morning. Mark chapter 8, verses 2 through 5 is going to be our opening text today. Mark chapter 8, verses 2 through 5, please. This is the text that we studied last time from Mark's gospel. As we consider the incredible Jesus, we looked at the situation of the transfiguration, this incredible scene that unfolded before the eyes of Peter, James, and John. I want to read that this morning to set up our study together. Mark chapter 8, beginning in verse number 2. Mark 9, verse number 2. After six days, Jesus, the text tells us, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves to be alone. And he was transfigured in front of them, and his clothes became dazzling, extremely white, as no launderer on earth could whiten them. And Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us set up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah," because he did not know what to say, since they were terrified. I want to continue on reading. And a cloud appeared overshadowing them, and a voice came from the cloud. And this is what this voice from the cloud, from the heavens, said. It said, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." This transfiguration, as we noted in the last study, it calls our attention back to Moses and the great exodus that he led the Israelite people out of from Egypt. We noted that it is now seemingly Mark's desire to draw the attention of the reader, not just to Moses, but to the fact that Jesus is seemingly assuming a Moses-type role. That he is assuming this Moses role of leading a great exodus, yet instead of leading a singular people out of a literal land, out of literal captivity to a people, he seeks to lead the whole world out of the captivity of sin, out of the guilt that weighs upon us, that Marty talked about, the dominion of sin that is upon us through the influence of this world. Jesus is seeking to lead people out of that and to lead them to the promised land, yet not a literal land per se here, but a land of freedom, again, free from the guilt and the dominion of sin. And here on this mountaintop experience, these three disciples, Peter and James and John, they are able to see that firsthand, and they are able to hear the emphasis of the voice from heaven that says, "This is my beloved Son. You listen to him. He is the one who has come to deliver you. He, as you have already professed, is the Christ. He is the Messiah. He is the chosen and the anointed one." Yet, what I want us to recognize is that the similarities between Jesus and Moses in this mountaintop experience, it doesn't end with what happens on the mountain. If you go back to Exodus 32, we remember that after Moses has been on the mountain and after he has received the 10 commandments with the few that are gathered there with him, he descends into chaos. He comes down off of the mountain and the people have lost faith. The people's belief in God has waned. Their belief in Moses as the leader of their nation, it has failed, for they have now taken off their golden rings. And they have fashioned from these rings a calf, an image of an earthly beast. And they say, "This, Israel, this is the God that has led you out of Egypt." Certainly such a situation is only going to be a result of the people who are lacking in belief, who are lacking in trust, who are lacking in confidence in their true deliverer. While Jesus doesn't descend himself into a scene of idolatry, he does descend into a mess. He descends into chaos, and that chaos stems yet again from unbelief. Yet, what I want us to recognize is that this ought not to be anything that surprises us from Mark's gospel, right? This should not be anything that surprises us, for we have seen within Mark's gospel, particularly this section beginning in about halfway through chapter 6, that the focal point has been on unbelief and the lack of understanding of so many people who come in contact with Jesus. We're going to focus on that again this morning within this text, from the text of Mark chapter 9 and verses 14 through 32. Mark chapter 9 and verses 14 through 32. We're going to consider this morning how the servant that God has sent, this great servant, Jesus the Messiah, how he has come to help unbelief. Let's begin by reading this text together, and then we're going to take a few moments to work our way through this text. Yeah, this is what I want us to focus on. What I want us to focus on this morning, and this is going to lead us to our main point, I want to focus on the deficiencies of people in unbelief. Focus on the deficiencies of the unbelief of people and how Jesus is going to use this to point them towards the all-sufficiency of himself, and not just of himself, but of God, his Father, as well. Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 14, please. Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 14. When they, being Jesus, Peter, James, and John, when they came to the disciples after they had descended the mountain, they saw a large crowd around them and the scribes disputing with them. And when the whole crowd saw him, they were amazed and ran to greet him. And he asked them, Jesus asked these people, he said, what are you arguing with them about? And someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams at the mouth, grinds his teeth, and he becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive it out, but they couldn't. He, being Jesus, replied to them, you unbelieving generation, how long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him to me. So they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, it immediately threw the boy into convulsions. He fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. How long has this been happening to him? Jesus asked the father. The father said, from childhood, and at many times it has thrown him into the fire or water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, this desperate father says, if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Jesus said to him, if you can, everything is possible for the one who believes. And immediately the father of the boy cried out, I do believe. Help my unbelief. And when Jesus saw that the crowd was quickly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to you, mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. Then it came out shrieking and throwing him into terrible convulsions, and the boy became like a corpse. So the many said, he's dead. But Jesus, taking him by the hand, raised him, and he stood up. After he, being Jesus, had gone into the house, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? And he told them, this kind can only come out by nothing but prayer. Verse 30 says, then they left that place and made their way through Galilee. And he did not want anyone to know it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed to the hands of men. They will kill him. And after 3 days, and he will rise 3 days later. But verse 32, they did not understand the statements, and they were afraid to ask him. As we take this text as a whole within the context, again, of this section, I believe, beginning about chapter 6 and around verse 30, we see this constant struggle of unbelief that is found within the people that Jesus interacts with, this constant struggle of unbelief. Because while Peter, James, and John, while they are probably still riding what has to be an incredible high from being able to see Moses and Elijah here on that mountain conversing with Jesus and having seen Jesus in that extremely glorified form and having heard that voice from heaven, this is my beloved son, listen to him. While they must still be riding this incredible high, the reality is that the rest of the disciples that are at the foot of the mountain, they're in a very tough spot. They're struggling because while Jesus is with these three closest of his disciples, they are without a rabbi. They are without Jesus. And as we see often, when Jesus isn't in the midst of the disciples, they often find themselves struggling, don't they? Whenever Jesus isn't there in their presence, we find them struggling. And this certainly is the case here for this man. This man brings his demon-possessed son to Jesus. He has an unclean spirit. This unclean spirit is extremely harmful to this boy. And it isn't just the fact that this unclean spirit possesses him and he isn't able to live freely of it, but it causes real tangible harm to this boy. It causes him to the best I can tell, to something that we might be able to comprehend, like severe seizures. The falling down to the ground, the rolling around, the rigidness of the body, the grinding of teeth, the foaming. But not only that, the spirit trying to cause this boy to be tossed into the fire, to burn him, or water, to destroy him. This dad is desperate, is he not? It's been happening since childhood. He doesn't know what else to do. Yet he's heard about this Jesus. We can assume that, can't we? We can assume, based upon this text and other texts, that the fame of Jesus certainly precedes him, that his reputation precedes him, and that people have heard of what he can do. People have heard of his teachings. People have heard that he can cast out spirits and that he can heal the broken. They hear that this is where Jesus is. They come, and yet all they find is his disciples. Yet the assumption is that these men, being his closest disciples, being his handpicked apostles, they can have some power in the situation too. That they can influence the situation. And in fact, we know they could, don't we? We know that they have the power to do this. That's what Jesus gave them power to do. Go back to Mark 6 in verse number 7 or verse 13. Mark 6, verse 7, he summoned the 12 and began to send them out in pairs, and he gave them authority over unclean spirits. Verse 13 says, they drove out many demons, anointed many sick people with oil, and healed them. As they've been sent out, they have been given this power to do these things. And it seems that they have the assumption they can still do these things. It's not like that the man brings this boy to the disciples, and they say, no, we can't do it. We don't have the power to do that. They tried. They put forth effort to do so. And yet it is in this failed effort that the scribes who happen to be here, that they pounce on the situation. They pounce on the situation because here is this rabbi, this teacher, who has accrued such a following, who teaches with such great authority, who performs these miraculous deeds, and there are people who are really raving about Jesus, and yet here are his apostles, his closest followers, his handpicked pupils, who are failing. This is exactly what they're looking for. They're salivating. They are licking at their chops, thinking, here is an opportunity for this man to be discredited through the failures of his pupils. Here is our opportunity. So what's going through the apostles' mind? What gives? Why can't they do this? Certainly only questions, uncertainty, and frustration can be found in this scene at this time. And that's the scene that Jesus walks into. Just as there was chaos at the foot of Mount Sinai in Exodus 32, there's chaos here in this moment. Jesus descends the mountain. He comes among this crowd. And I am curious as to the people's response to Jesus. Because do you see the response within the text? Verse 15, when the whole crowd saw him, they were amazed and ran to him. I wonder why. Why were they amazed by Jesus? This was not the first time that people had seen Jesus. Now, while there was a marveling at Jesus, while people were impressed by Jesus, astounded by Jesus even, it says they were amazed. I wonder if maybe there's some residual effect from the transfiguration here. I wonder if Jesus in some way still is showing some residual effect of glory. Maybe his clothes were still a bit wider than normal. I don't know. I don't know exactly what's going on here, why they would run to Jesus in this way. That seems out of the ordinary, because that doesn't seem the normal response from people. Yet they do recognize who he is. They do recognize there's something special about him, and they do run to him. And he asks, well, what's the problem here? What's the issue? And that's when the dad speaks up. Listen, Jesus, I brought my son to your disciples. I expected that they'd have the ability to heal him, and yet they have failed. They failed to get the job done. And it is at this point that Jesus laments. And this is a lament, I believe. This is a lament of Jesus. That this struggle of unbelief, the struggle of unbelief is still present among those closest to him. And yet, let me suggest to you, it's not just among those closest to him, but there is just unbelief that is running rampant throughout this text. That's our first point this morning. Jeff, if you had that, go ahead and throw up the second point for me too, please. This is what Jesus is moving to. Jesus is moving towards the fact that greater belief is required. Greater belief is required. Why is greater belief required? Well, because there is unbelief. There is the presence of unbelief. Again, I've made mention that unbelief is highlighted in this particular section of Mark's gospel, starting in chapter 6 and verse 30, moving onward. Just from the apostles' perspective, just from their viewpoint, there is unbelief in their hearts. They're struggling at times. Think with me about Mark 6 again, beginning in Mark 6 and verse 30 through verse 52, and then carrying on into chapter 8. Think about the fact that the disciples, these apostles, were not truly able to appreciate the miraculous feeding of the 5,000. They were not able to appreciate the significance of Jesus walking on the water in the storm. Why? Because their hearts were hardened. Because they didn't believe. They did not understand. That's what Mark tells us specifically in that text of Mark 6. Yet we're hoping that they're growing past that unbelief, are we not? We're hoping that they're growing past that inability to understand, because they're actually given a second opportunity to recognize Jesus' all-sufficiency to provide again in that second great feeding. Remember that second great feeding in chapter 8, the 4,000? That the exact same situation is presented before them, and they have the opportunity to say in that moment, whenever Jesus says, well, what are we going to do? They can say, oh, Jesus, you got this. We've already seen this. That was 5,000 you took care of this. 4,000 is going to be nothing for you. Yeah, even in that second miraculous feeding, they still fail to recognize Jesus as having the power in that situation. Not only that, but don't they completely swing and miss? They whiff at Jesus' warnings concerning the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod in Mark chapter 8 and verses 11 through 21. And at the end of that text, what does he do? He ties in their inability to understand that warning with their hardened hearts and their inability to understand the feedings, the feeding of the 5,000. And even after the great confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, even after they have confessed that, and again, Peter, I believe, even spokesman for the group as well, they're starting to get it. What happens? Well, then Peter turns right around and rebukes Jesus once he tells him about what he's going to have to endure as the Son of Man, what God has destined him to experience. We understand the reality that they saw to some degree. They had a level of belief. And yet at the same time, they still had a ways to go, did they not? They still had a ways to go. And this is illustrated, I believe, as we mentioned in a couple lessons ago, in Jesus' healing of the blind man in stages, that he first works upon the man, and the man's blind eyes are open to an extent. But instead of seeing things clearly as most of us see right now, things are blurry. Like trees that are blowing in the wind. The image is not sharp. You know, then he works on the man again. And at that point, his sight is restored. That is an illustration of what the apostles are going through. In fact, is it not, brothers and sisters, an illustration of what is happening in this very text? Yes, the apostles believe in Jesus, but there remains unbelief as well, which is what led to their failure. And it's what led to this man having to suffer consequences because of their unbelief. Yet in this text, is there not also unbelief on the part of the dad? Now the dad, he comes to Jesus, and we see the struggle that's going on within him. He has just seen the apostles. He has just seen men, though they are endowed with power to cast out demons and to disperse demons and to heal, as we've seen back in Mark 6. Even though they've had this power, they failed in this moment. And what has that done? That has influenced him to have some doubt concerning even Jesus, it seems. That's seen in the statement he makes in verse 22, is it not? But if you can do anything, if you can do anything, have compassion on and help us. From this man's perspective, I think based on what he has seen with the disciples, the handpicked pupils and their failures, now it's causing him to have a bit of unbelief in Jesus himself. If you can help me, please do so. And Jesus responds with, if you can. If you can what? If you can, verse 23, that's the question. He's questioning his question. And then he makes this declarative statement that everything is possible for the one who believes. Brothers and sisters, the reality is this wasn't a question at all on Jesus's part concerning what he was able to do. We must recognize that. This is not a judgment on what Jesus is capable of doing. That's not what is that question here. Not at all. No, the onus in the situation, it laid at the feet of this man's belief in Jesus. And it likewise laid at the feet of the apostles of Jesus, because they apparently were not where they needed to be in order to do what had been requested of them at this moment. Again, everything is possible for the one who believes. In other words, what Jesus is saying, he's saying, friend, I am capable of doing anything I want. But do you, he says, believe this is the case? Do you trust that I am able and willing to do such a thing? And let's give this man credit, because there's a very quick response here, isn't there? There's a very quick response. He says, I do believe that you're capable of this. But here's the incredible part thing about this man. His humility shows through in the fact that he says, yes, I believe you can do this, but I realize that I am still lacking in belief in some ways. Lord, help my unbelief. I'm not just concerned in this moment for my son, but I'm concerned for the fact that I'm lacking in belief, that I'm not where I need to be. Lord, I know that you can not only help my son, but I have confidence that you can also help my unbelief. And Jesus responds by doing that very thing. He heals the boy, raises him up, even though he looks like he's a lifeless corpse, and he sends him on with his dad. Certainly we can assume, I believe rightly, that after this great ordeal, this man's belief in Jesus, it was strengthened. It grew, that his belief was helped, that he achieved greater belief in this situation. And yet, as we move forward, we see a question from the apostles in this moment. We see a question because as they move into a more private setting, they ask this question to Jesus in verse 28. They said, why couldn't we drive it out? You know, I think we've already seen the answer to this question, haven't we? We've already seen the answer to why they can't. I believe Jesus has already answered this question when he laments this unbelieving generation. How long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? This rebuke of unbelief seems to be something that's being applied to everybody in this situation. Everybody that he finds as he descends the mountain, everybody has to struggle with belief. We know the scribes did not believe in Jesus. They were looking for any way in which they could discredit him. The dad shows his lack of belief and seemingly being unsure as to whether or not Jesus was able or willing to heal his son. And then here are the apostles who are the cause of this fiasco, who are the cause of this problem in their inability to cast out the unclean spirit in the first place, something that we have seen explicitly as being something they are capable of doing. There is plenty of unbelieving blame to go around, but it begins with the apostles. And they're asking, why couldn't we do this? And Jesus is going to use this opportunity to help them to grow past unbelief. And he emphasizes and specifies that that which is going to help them is prayer. Prayer. That it was going to be prayer, consistency in prayer, that would help take the attention off of themselves. That's really what's going on here. The attention for themselves is in the wrong place. You can even see it in the way that they ask this. Why couldn't we do that? Why couldn't we do that? But it wasn't about them, was it? It wasn't about their power. For in reality, they had no power in and of themselves, right? Remember, go back to chapter 6. Jesus gave them that power. Jesus gave them the ability and the authority over unclean spirits. What they need to recognize is they need to lean upon the authority and the power of God. And they needed to be reminded in this moment that they needed to fully trust in what he could do through them. And what he could accomplish through them based upon their belief. Again, think about it through the perspective of the other miracles we've seen up to this point. Even back all the way up to chapter 1. Think about belief and faith being at the center of nearly every single one of them. The leprous man of Mark chapter 1, he believed Jesus had the power to heal him. He believed that. That's why he came to Jesus. That's why he broke protocol in order to come to Jesus. The friends of the paralyzed man, they had faith. They had belief in Jesus. The text tells us that Jesus saw their faith. He saw their belief and their willingness to go to great lengths in order to drop this man down through the ceiling in order to heal him. We see their faith and belief. Jairus had belief in Jesus. The woman suffering from bleeding had such great belief in Jesus that she said, even if I could just touch the hem of his garment, I believe I can be healed. The Gentile mother in chapter 7 showed tremendous faith in Jesus having the ability to heal her daughter. There are many Gentiles that we see that have faith and belief in Jesus and his ability to heal them, specifically those who brought the deaf and mute man to him in chapter 7 and verses 31 through 37. What we see is that time and time again, we see the subjects at the center of these miracles exhibiting incredible belief. What is belief? Well, it can't be simple acknowledgement of a fact or the presence of something. Obviously, the man believed Jesus was standing there before him. But does it not go back to trust? It's trust. It's confidence. Confidence in what Jesus is capable of doing. These people, they trusted that he could do even far beyond what they imagined was possible. And for that belief and for that trust, Jesus did incredible things in the presence of these individuals. Not just believing Jews, mind you, but even believing Gentiles. How could then Jesus' apostles come and have the same type of faith? Well, what a horrible thing to say to them. Could you imagine walking up to them in a moment and said, let me tell you the way to have a faith of a Gentile. Woo-hoo! Man, that burned them up. And yet, that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. How could they have the faith of a Gentile mother, Gentile friends? And it came through prayer. It would come through prayer. It would come through devotion to God. It would come through their expressing of their fervent trust in God's power and his ability to accomplish his will through them. They needed to give more time and attention to the Lord as the source of what they were able to do as Jesus's apostles. I can only come to the conclusion that they hadn't been doing that. Now, they had not been fervent in prayer. That they had not been fervent in devotion to God, which is why Jesus says this kind. He said, he's saying here, this kind of faith, this kind of belief that can accomplish these things, it only comes through prayer. If they wanted to have greater faith, if they wanted to have greater belief, then they needed to go to the source of their faith and belief to begin with. They needed to devote themselves to persistent prayer. Why though? Why prayer? Or we might say this, what other effects? What other consequences were present in their lives because of their lack of prayer, which results in the lack of unbelief? Well, we can see that in the final portion of our text this morning. The fact that their struggles continue throughout this journey with Jesus, that they leave this place and they go through Galilee. And as they're going through Galilee, Jesus doesn't want people to know that he's there. Maybe he doesn't want them to know he's there because of what's specified within the text, that he was given attention to really stressing to them and really teaching them, impressing upon them the fact that he was going to be betrayed into the hands of men, that he was going to be killed, and that he was going to be raised on the third day. He really wanted to stress that to them. He really wanted them to know this, to understand this, to grasp this, so that whenever it happened, they would be ready, they would be able to respond appropriately. And yet the text tells us here, it tells us that they didn't understand. They didn't understand. Again, we've seen this before. We've seen this very thing before. Back just a chapter sooner in chapter 8. They make the confession, you are the Christ, you are the Son of God. He turns around and says, this is what it means. And Peter says, no, Lord, I'm rebuking. That's not what's going to happen. Here we see this continuing. And here's the thing, they could have helped this lack of understanding. They could have asked Jesus. They could have tried to flesh it out with him. Yet instead of asking him, instead of trying to work it out with him, what do? They remain silent. Why? Because of fear. They were afraid to ask them. These disciples, again, show themselves as fearful men. They were afraid of both of the situations whenever they're on the sea, whether it's chapter 4 and verse 40, chapter 6 and verse 15. They feared in those moments. They feared and they let that fear grip them in unbelief. And we have to recognize, brothers and sisters, that fear is the enemy of belief. Fear is the enemy of belief in God and the power that he has. Jesus told Jairus in chapter 5 and verse 36, don't be afraid, only believe. Showing the contrast of these two things, fear and belief. The woman who had the bleeding issue, though she was scared, once Jesus turned around and says, who touched me? She overcomes that fear by going to Jesus and said, it was me. It was me. The reality is that fear can either push us further away from God, or we can use that fear to push us towards God, to allow him to strengthen us to overcome the fears that grip us. Here in this moment, the fear of the disciples was causing them to be hindered in greater faith, in greater understanding, in greater belief. And oh, by the way, didn't he just tell them, you need to pray more. You need to be more consistent and persisted in prayer. And yet we are reminded that this was a process. That they were not going to get where they needed to be overnight. It was going to take time. And thankfully for them, their rabbi is the most patient man to have ever walked this earth. What are we to do with these things? What are we to do with these considerations this morning? Let's ask a couple of questions for our benefit of trying to use this text to grow in our own faith. Here's this first question. Does my behavior and or mindset betray that I don't believe in Jesus as I should? Does my behavior, does the way I live or the way I think, does it betray what is actually the case? That I don't believe as I ought to. We would do well to consider our own belief in Jesus. And it is easy for us to say, yes, I believe in Jesus and I believe in the power he possesses. But does our behavior and mindset, does it prove that to be true? Yes, we acknowledge Jesus as holding the title as the Son of God and that he is God himself. But are we to the point in our faith where that is just the obvious point in our life? Do we believe that has an obvious impact on the way that we live and the way that we think? Because we have to realize that the same struggles they had, fear and worry, they're in the text. But brothers and sisters, are they not in our lives as well? Are fear and worry facets of life that cause us fear and worry? We're obviously worried about the pandemic situation. We are worried about the direction of our society and our culture, the direction in which it is moving. We are worried about a number of things that are connected to these things, that stem from these things. But do we, at the same time, while we recognize the legitimacy of these issues, do we at the same time recognize all the more the ability of our God to have complete control over these things? Do we realize and do we recognize, do we embrace the fact that none of these things are outside of God's control? Do we recognize that none of these things will ever overpower our God?
Amen.
Do we realize that none of these things can therefore overpower us if we are truly believing or trusting in his power to sustain us? And to sustain our faith even in the darkest of situations, do we need to be reminded, as Jairus was reminded, don't be afraid, only believe? Do we need to be reminded of that more often? Do we push God to the background and try to work through these things on our own? We say we believe in God. We say we believe in his strength, but are we still trying to do things on our own? Do we fight against the worries and the fears on our own strength? Do we find ourselves constantly beat down and tired because we are trying to do these things on our own? If we do, if we find ourselves tired from the struggle of doing it on our own, then we must recognize our shortcomings in unbelief. That we are an unbelieving people. And we must beg God, as this father did, to help our unbelief, because there is no way to overcome this except in that way. That's what Jesus says. This is only going to happen. Overcoming this lack of belief, overcoming these struggles, is only going to happen when we throw ourselves at the feet of God, that we rely totally on his grace, his mercy, and his strength. In that moment, we will overcome. In that moment, we will succeed. So that leads us into the second question. Does prayer have the proper place in my life that it should? I remind us of Jesus' own example that he found it necessary and beneficial to sneak away from time to time to dedicate himself in prayer to his Father. And if the Son of God himself and deity himself recognize that as being something necessary, surely we ought to as well. However, we need to recognize that we might not give the proper attention to prayer because we quantify successful prayer in the wrong way. I think this because I know I am this way, that I see prayer as being something beneficial only when that which I pray for happens. I pray for healing for a friend, and I see that prayer only as being good whenever that friend is healed. I see prayer as being beneficial only whenever I am able to see the situation work out in the way that I have asked for it to work out. And let me suggest to you that when I do that, when we do that, we are failing. We are failing in unbelief. That is the wrong way to see prayer. That is the wrong way to consider whether or not prayer has been time well spent. Let me suggest to you that time spent in prayer that is spent with sincere, honest hearts, where our only desire is to pour ourselves before God, to pour ourselves at his feet, to take all the cares, all the worries, all the fears, and to lay them at his feet, and to acknowledge to him that you are able to carry these things, that none of this is outside of your control, that you have power over everything that I am powerless against. It is in that moment that we confess to him, and we confess to him for our souls. We believe he is in that moment, brothers and sisters, that prayer is time well spent, and that we will be most benefited even in our deepest struggles. The reality is we might not receive that which we have asked for. And when that happens, the temptation of the evil one before us is to think that either God doesn't care or that he wasn't able to do that which I asked. And brothers and sisters, that type of attitude, that type of thinking within our hearts must be defeated. It must be destroyed, because it does not come down to whether or not God cares. We know he cares. We know he has compassion on us. And it is not a result of what of his incapability. He is capable of all things. Jesus said, everything is possible for the one who believes. What we must recognize is we cannot comprehend the all-knowing mind of God. We don't have divine perspective. We cannot comprehend oftentimes that what we were praying for actually was not according to the will of God. That's not what he wanted done, what he desired to do. And in those moments, those are the greatest opportunities for us to grow in belief. When even though what we want hasn't happened, we still believe that he has the power to do all things well, that all things in the end will work out for his glory, and that they will work out according to his deed. Do we show that type of mindset? Do we show that type of attitude in how often and how fervently we pray? Let's think about the words of Jude, Jude 20 and Jude 21. But you, dear friends, as you build yourselves up in your most holy faith, praying in the Holy Spirit, keep yourselves in the love of God, waiting expectantly for our Lord Jesus Christ for eternal life. As we seek to grow and build ourselves up in faith and belief and trust and confidence of God, may we recognize that that is only going to come through prayer. If we neglect prayer, we are neglecting our faith. We are neglecting our faith. May that never be us. This is what I want us to leave with. These are the conclusions that we need to recognize. God is, his ability is infinite. It is absolutely infinite. There is nothing God is not capable of doing. The only shortcoming is our faith. The only time there's a shortcoming is in our belief. Therefore, our prayer must be continually, Lord, help my unbelief. It's just like the apostles, we have so much room in which to grow. We have so much room in which we can improve our belief and trust in Jesus. We often want to judge the faithfulness of Jesus and of God, and whether or not things go the way we want them to in our lives. But we must grow past that mindset. We must grow past that expectation and allow him to help our unbelief in recognizing his faithfulness and the fact that it will be seen in our persevering. In our continued faithfulness, his faithfulness is proven. Regardless of the test that stands before us, whatever it might be, may we find success by continuing to trust in him, by continuing to remain faithful, and by showing at all times our belief and a willingness to obey him, to trust him, to follow him wherever he might lead. As we continue through this difficult time in our lives, may we be a people who are constant in prayer, persistent in prayer, and ever growing in our belief and trust in God to see us through to the end. Though we believe already, I know we all believe. We all believe to an extent. But we also have unbelief at the same time. We're not there yet. May he help us to grow past our weaknesses, to grow past our points of unbelief, and to trust in him more fully each and every day. The great servant Jesus, he came to this earth to help unbelief. May he continue to help our unbelief as well. And maybe this morning for you, your help is